everybody, welcome to episode 29 of Here We Go Again, Israeli Politics. We'd like to welcome Yitzi Marcus, our co-host for this week's episode. Terrorist attack in Jerusalem. Shabak tracking started and stopped after political backlash. Bennett's family goes on vacation and the country gets pissed. Netanyahu's prosecution continues to collapse. Kashrus reform begins and the appointing of the Supreme Court justices was delayed. This is Here We Go Again. Okay, for our first topic, this past Shabbat afternoon in Jerusalem, Israel, near Shar Shechem, there was a terrorist attack. A 16-year-old Palestinian that did not have work permits or entrance permits to Israel was walking on the street and passed by a Haredi Jew, turned around behind him and started stabbing him multiple times. Then two Magav, the Israeli police army, came to protect him. And as he ran away and ended up shooting the terrorist fell down on the ground and then tried to turn over and get up, and they shot him multiple times while he was on the ground. This situation brought up many public lashes and discussion where the Arab Knesset members and the ultra-left-wing Knesset members such as Ayman Uda came out and said that it was a lifeless killing and that it shows that we have no morals, while they were shooting him while he was already on the ground. And on the other side, you would come up and say that this really was clearly a terrorist that came and already was stabbing someone, and that would be the thing that's lifeless and immoral in the first place, and that him getting up was the danger in the first place, and that's why he must have to have been shot once more.
So this of course brought up the Elor Azaria story from a few years back in Hebron, where he shot the guy after he was on the ground. He was of course sent to prison. He was discharged from the army. It was a big disgrace for the country overall. We need to acknowledge that this so-called left-wing government stood by the soldiers in a way that Netanyahu's never did. Bennett, Lapid, the police immediately all came out with statements of support for the soldiers, saying they acted exactly as soldiers are expected to do. They also immediately published the full footage that showed that the guy was trying to get up, very important for public perception. And basically, they doused this fire before it began, unlike the last time that we had a mess like this.
But with that, they were still taken into,
investigation.
They were investigated, which normally, and then their statement was, to those who are listening, that they came out and said, no, we investigate every shooting that there is, which is just not true. We've seen in the past that when the shooting is cleared, everyone is justified, there is no investigation that goes through. Maybe some paperwork, but they're not brought into investigation, and in this situation they did. We can't deny that situation.
They also, from what I've understood, still don't have access to their guns. Their guns were taken away right after the shooting. They were brought in for investigation. Not just an investigation, it was a Chakira Be'Azhara, which is a criminal investigation specifically. Really bad, but I think the police saw that once the government, everyone was backing the situation, they kind of backed off. But of course, what they wanted to do was immediately prosecute these people, because that's what we do in this country.
But I feel that that makes it worse. Your last statement, that the police understood that the politicians are not backing it, so therefore they backed down, that's not the position of the police. If the police are supposed to do their job to defend justice when it comes to, you know, whether or not it was legal or illegal, it should make no relevance whether or not the entire political map is saying you should prosecute them. The police should say, guess what, it's not illegal. And if they decided to take them to investigate them because they said the shooting was dangerous, therefore, even if the Prime Minister, which Naftali Bennett got up and said that he's totally giving them support, and the commander of that police force came up and said that he's supporting them, the investigators should make no difference to them.
You're right in an ideological level, but I don't think that's practically true anywhere. Police take their cues from their higher-ups and from the system at large and from public perception, for the same reason that we don't take the handicapped people in the Haredim that are sitting in the highway blocking traffic and beat the snot out of them. It's public perception. Legally, they should all be arrested. They broke the law. They blocked a public highway. But perception plays a role into police work. It does everywhere. And I'm not surprised it does here, too.
Okay, so with that, we'd like to send a quick recovery to the Jew that was stabbed, and we from that continue forth, we would also, you know, this morning there was another terrorist, a vehicle that rammed into a security guard at an outpost, and a security guard was injured as well, and the terrorist was shot on the spot. There's not much backlash or political debate that's going on in that situation, but it's really just to show that the situation is, like, on the one end, I want to be careful not to say the word heating up, because this is all single people that are doing their terrorists, but we know that one causes the other, and they this it's a movement pushing forward. We obviously hope it tones down, but the one thing we'll say... Okay, so for our next topic...
We're going to touch back onto the COVID situation, what's been going on. The whole globe had its Omicron scare. Things seem to have calmed down overall, but there were some interesting political developments in the process here in Israel. Basically, the country jumped on it like a lot of countries did. They locked things down. They added quarantines for people coming into the country. They stopped foreign travel. But the controversial bit is that they tried to, or they did, reenact the Shabak's tracing of people's cell phones to determine contact. So they're doing contact tracing via people's cell phones without warrants. Of course, in America, this could never, ever, ever, ever happen. It's a huge violation of public rights, private rights, but we don't have private rights in the state of Israel the way you would know them. So this was deemed legal. They reactivated them, and a lot of the government strongly disagreed. A lot of them were in opposition of this policy when they were in the opposition for the last round, because it is a huge invasion of privacy. As it was found, there was a big public outcry about it. People got very upset, and as they found out that Omicron actually isn't that bad, they did stop it pretty quickly. They bowed to the pressure, and they stopped the private tracing of cell phones.
So the tracing really went on in the end for 5 days, was from start to finish. I think that there's two factors here. The first is what you touched at the start is, you know, on this podcast, we've bashed many things that this government has done when it came to dealing with COVID, you know, especially coming from Naftali Bennett's, you know, whole things that he is the ultimate person who knows how to deal with COVID. And it was a pretty much a catastrophe at the start, at least from a government's perspective. They did not handle it at all in the way that it should. But with saying that, I think that in this current situation, they actually dealt with it exactly how I think that it should have been dealt with. They came in, they did not have information. We can get to a debate for a second what you're planning to do for the next 10 years from now every time something like this happens, and that's a legitimate discussion to have. But in this current situation, we get information from South Africa. We understand there's something that potentially is very, very dangerous. They immediately showed that they worked very quick. That is true. They shut down the entrance for anyone that's not a citizen. They brought back the bidud in the quarantine of 3 days. They also didn't go some crazy 2 weeks quarantine. They were very, very... Everything they did, agree or disagree, had logic behind it. And there was a move, and they did it very fast. And now the big test is how quickly they could dial back. Because that's the move, especially if you go to what could be happening next time, is there's no problem. But it makes sense to come and say, we need to put quarantine for 3 days immediately on anyone that's coming in, and we're blocking all flights. But it also means that as fast as possible, when you get the information that it is something that the vaccines can deal with and it is not dangerous, to start dialing back and opening up.
Yeah, and that's honestly where I think they're falling short right now. They did do very extensive drilling on a situation like this prior to this even happening. About a month and a half ago, there was a huge drill of simulating a war game, essentially, of what happens if they detect a new variant that the vaccine is useless against, and how they can enact everything immediately. And I think Omicron was a quick example of some of the things that they drilled working effectively. They were immediately on top of the airports. They were able to isolate the 3 cases that came into the country, figure it all out. It was very effective. The problem is now. It's a problem I think that all governments are facing globally. Politically, there is zero interest in not being extra cautious at the price of the public. Because the alternative is way worse in the absence of the known, right? Even if it's a very small percentage that everything gets horrible, you're still going to lock down because you're going to be the one on the hook for it, and it doesn't cost you that much to just lock down, to just stop. So, like in this case, it was very easy to stop things and say, all right, 2 weeks. Now, once we realize that the vaccine is useful and that things are not looking so bad, really the decision should have been made yesterday when they had a meeting to be like, okay, so we don't need the quarantine for 3 days. We don't need all these things. Foreigners can come back in. Instead, they're going to wait the full 2 weeks just because it's easier. And it's a political fallacy that is the nature of politics, I think.
So I think this connects to another small situation regarding this, and this is really the family of Bennett. So for those who don't know, Bennett's family, the Prime Minister, had a vacation planned, and it was planned for the holiday of Hanukkah to fly. Their vacation was planned, I don't remember which country exactly, and then as right before they took off, this whole situation went in, and they enacted the mandatory quarantine and closing the borders, and Naftali Bennett himself came up and said to everyone, please do not fly. If you can, we're not going to tell you it's illegal, but we request from everyone to stop from flying and going out to the States, to abroad. And then what happened was that his family, there was a little bit of backlash before they took off, saying, wait, but his family's planning to fly while he says, and then his family did, and we have to be very clear for a second, legally speaking, his family then switched the location of their vacation to somewhere that's not a red country, but rather a green country in which you are able to fly to. Everything they did was legally acceptable, and then they took off for a vacation. The problem was that this, for very obvious reasons, gave a lot of backlash, because you're telling the whole country you guys should be not be flying, and then your family is going on a vacation. My personal feeling on the matter is twofold. On the one hand, look, this is not fun for his family. This is not an easy situation they've been in since he went into power. Actually, and even different to where many times, you know, you say some people are like, they don't have a lot of money, or they're not in very good situations, and for any reasons, and then they go into politics. So like, yeah, it comes with a big cause, but wow, actually you become a very important person, you get to become a very wealthy person, and there's also bonuses. In this situation, if I look at like the child of Naftali Bennett, there's literally nothing positive of him becoming prime minister in almost any atmosphere. You were already wealthy, you already were popular in the country, if that gives you value, because he was a minister and he had a lot of, you know, things. He has a beautiful home, and from every perspective, they became now, where they live is on lockdown. The people around them hate him. The people in Ra'anana are vicious at the family there. They gain nothing. So finally, they went on a vacation like anyone else, and I could see his wife saying, look, I supported you and allowed you to be the prime minister, which is partially ruining our life. We are going on this vacation, and Naftali Bennett not really having what to do about this. The other side of that is, yeah, it was wrong, but you know what I have to come out and say, and I think it was a wrong decision, but Naftali Bennett came up and said publicly, he said, the prime minister is open to ridicule as well, and you should, and he said, and you know what, our decision was wrong. He said that this is wrong, so I think that's taking responsibility. I don't think that cleans the people that are angry at him, have the right to continue being angry at the situation, but he did take responsibility and say, you know what, they shouldn't have flown, this wasn't right, but it's always easier to say that looking back.
I think it was a little blown out of proportion, and it wasn't exactly as it was painted. By the time they decided to fly, or they actually flew, we already knew that Omicron wasn't a big deal. It was just that 3 days prior, Bennett had asked everyone that it's better to not fly, and he hadn't walked that back yet. He did that day. That day, he made a public announcement saying that it is okay to fly. It was just a matter of public perception, and it was bad PR. Reports did come out that the Prime Minister's office did try to convince Galit not to fly, and she refused. She felt that their family needed it, and I think that's completely legitimate. They flew within the rules. They did the quarantine within the rules. They have rights just like anyone else. It's purely a personal PR question for the Prime Minister. Was it bad PR? Yes, but that's his own problem.
Right, but I'm saying it's legitimate for people to be angry that it happened.
Why angry?
Because in the end, you're trying to tie everyone down and say,
but he didn't.
He applied
the same rules to his family that he did to everyone else.
Well, he requested people not to fly.
He said that he recommends not flying. Okay, he probably recommended it to his wife too.
Okay, let me ask you this question, which is backwards in things. You know, you're saying that 2 weeks, I would come out and state that the reason they're not lowering down the quarantine right now is from backwards perspective. Is that they don't want to get to the situation in which she doesn't have the quarantine. It's funny. You'd think that he would try to shorten it. I think that there is a big backlash and fear that if today they say there's no longer quarantine and tomorrow she returns and then she gets out of the quarantine, there's going to be a big public...
That's easily resolvable by lifting the quarantine and saying that lifnei mishurat hadin, she is still going to stay in quarantine.
Well, let's see if that happens.
But they're not lifting it, so it doesn't matter.
I think they're going to lift it right after she returns. After she finishes the 3 days, then they're going to lift it.
Because the 2 weeks are going to be up. It doesn't matter. That's the policy ends in 2 weeks.
Then it's really inconvenient timing.
Yeah, but I think you could have lifted it for everyone and still had her go into quarantine and been fine.
Okay, for our next topic.
We're going to jump into Netanyahu's case. It's been ongoing. We've been hearing one of the primary witnesses in the trial, Nir Chepetz has been being questioned by the prosecution, finished, I believe, and now the defense is doing their cross-examination. It's been rough on the prosecution. I mean, from the get-go, it's been pretty clear that both police, investigators, prosecutors, and the prosecutor general of this country either never learned the job, don't know what they're doing, had an agenda. Either way, they're some of the worst that can be imagined. In very short, it's become clear that the investigators and the police use tactics that are blatantly illegal on him to get him to turn state's witness. They threatened his family, they threatened him, they lied in ways that are not allowed. They used all kinds of really third world tactics of sleep deprivation, and they threatened that they found out some secrets that they would tell his wife and she would divorce him. Really nasty stuff. This all came out in trial. The judges have been fuming. It's not surprising, given what we know about the Israeli police and their lack of decorum and their lack of regard for the rules. And this has to do with a core problem in the state of Israel, which is the lack of any laws regarding the fruit of the poisonous tree. For those who don't know what that is, in the United States and in other affluent countries, if the police obtain evidence in an illegal way, that evidence is now tainted and is not allowed to be used in court and can't be presented. Of course, what this does is discourages the police from acting in an illegal way because it's futile. They're basically just hurting their own case. In Israel, it's actually encouraged. Anything that is obtained can be used as long as it's relevant. So police regularly use illegal tactics because the end result is a win for them, and they're typically not actually investigated. There's no trial, there's no consequences, so they do what they want. In this case, it was particularly idiotic because of how public the scenario is. Given that this is the most important case that's ever been tried in the state of Israel, the prosecution of the longest sitting prime minister of the state of Israel, they were so not careful in the process from beginning to end. That goes for the prosecutors who wrote the charges wrong. That goes to the police and their behavior. It goes to the Yoetz Mishpati Mendelblit and his behavior. Everyone has been so, forget vindictive against him. We all knew that going in. They've been pathetic. Like, you'd expect them at least to do a good job in trying to get Netanyahu and bring him down, regardless of if the charges are true or not. At least do a good job. I happened to watch on the news the other night, Amit Segal debating the issue, and he's really calling out all the things that were done by the Chokrim here, that the investigators, that were really horrific, and how is the left, the champions of the people's rights, not saying anything? Because they just had all this huff about, they just did this huge piece about prisoners' rights in jail and how prisoners are treated and how terrorists are treated in prisons, but how people are investigated, nobody seems to care. Nir Chepetz is a guy who, innocent or not, did some shady things that may be fine, but his rights were completely trampled and nobody in the media or the left seems to care because it doesn't fit their agenda. The absurd response given to him by the anchors across the table was, well, you know, there were a lot of tactics that they could have used legally that they chose not to. They could have done all these nasty things to him that would have been legal, and they chose not to do it, and they chose to give him a break. So because they gave him a break on all the legal things they could have done, it's really okay that they did these other illegal things, because overall they treated him not so bad. And they legitimately believed this. I was in shock watching the TV.
I think that it's just a very complicated situation, because if you start back to one of the first sentences you said they're really terrible at their job, or that they don't learn how to do their job. Now, I mean, there's two factors to this. One is the saying that they're terrible in their successful ability to take him down, okay, which means if he gets thrown out in court because they were unsuccessful, then yeah, they'd be terrible. But so the other side is that I can just disagree with you on what their goal is in the first place. You know, you're looking at their goal is to bring justice. That's not the goal that they're seeing. Their job is to get the Bibi Netanyahu convicted. That is what their job is.
The prosecutor's job. The police's job is to find the truth.
No, that's
investigator.
So that's where you would look at the police, but they're looking at it like their entire job. They were brought on and virtually hired. Some of these people were only hired for this case. Their job is to investigate any person that can help bring
Netanyahu down. The point is to investigate it in a way to bring him down, that in itself is illegal.
I didn't say it's legal. So that's how they look at
the
position.
But that's the incompetence.
So when you're stating that they did a terrible job, they're doing... we're getting to the case, they did a bad job at that. But the idea of them, when you listen to Nir Chefetz and he's saying, it really just seemed like it was a hadifa, like just a witch hunt. They didn't care about anything else except for tell me what I can do to tell us what will... convict
But that's my point, right? Even if their goal was corrupt and they are in a corrupt organization and they are evil, they're doing a bad job at that. Like, at least do it right. At least, hide it a little bit. How about don't send your illegal transcripts to the defense? I don't know. Maybe double check your email. They're just so pathetically bad at everything they do, and it's sad. It's really, really sad.
Okay, and how do you see this pushing forward? Do you see the courts just throwing the case out and saying he's innocent of all charges?
I think the case is too big for them to dismiss it. I think any decent judge would, but given the PR about it, I think the backlash would be way too strong and they're too scared. They don't dismiss the charges. But the way the case is currently going now, the entire... judicial system is looking like a joke, and there's almost no way to actually find him guilty. I think even if they did find him guilty, it'll take a few years. The public would just lose more and more faith in them, because the public now no longer believes he's guilty of anything.
Well, that statement, I don't know if we could back that up in numbers, but the public is a very large number, because the public are also those who voted constantly saying that he needs to be removed because of these
cases. The public overwhelmingly voted in support of him. Every single poll has him at, 70% rating as the better person for prime minister, even now? I mean, the public overwhelmingly likes him and doesn't think there's a problem here. The public overwhelmingly doesn't trust the judicial system, or the police, or anyone involved there. It's just so blatantly obvious to everyone that their agenda...
So in that situation, where's the backlash? Then the Supreme Court should want to throw out the case.
No, the backlash is in the media.
Not the Supreme Court, sorry.
The backlash is in the media. And the media keeps trying to paint this as if there's still something going on. But there's not, because if you've just been watching the trial, it's been public. If you've just been watching things happen, it's a joke. I mean, we just had the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, right? I mean, we were all watching it like, wow, this is a joke. And he was, thank God he was let off and he was innocent and he was found innocent, rightfully so. This case is equally a joke. The evidence is all overwhelmingly not in the favor of the prosecution, but they're going to keep up this charade because they hung their hat on it. They're all going to lose their careers over this because it's so public and they're so, so bad. I mean, if we just look at polling numbers of what's been going on, you'd think a public trial would affect standings at all, but it really doesn't. If we look at who's right for the prime minister job, this was a poll done yesterday, and it was published on Channel 12 News. Netanyahu wins a 45% majority of who's right for the prime ministership. Bennett only has 25%, and neither gets 21%. If you expand that out to be not only Bennett versus Netanyahu, Netanyahu rises to 48%. Lapid gets 24%, and neither again at a 19%. So you're pretty consistent between Bennett and Lapid, almost split down the road, but Netanyahu doubles them. I mean, it's not even close. In terms of the public, it's very interesting, actually. The public has been kind of shifting. Polls don't match up. Because polling on the effectiveness of this current government has actually been pretty positive. People are overall happy with their performance and the way they've handled things. That being said, looking at the polling for voting, we're far out from an election, so the numbers don't matter so much. They do talk to sentiment. And the overall sentiment is going continuously towards the Likud. The Likud gains about 6 seats, not enough to form a government on their end, but it strips the government from this side. So they're losing ground. Yamina last polled in at 6 seats, which is one less than they've got last time, because remember they lost one of their members, so they're running on 6 now, but they actually got 7 in the election. They lost one, but also their base totally shifted, right? Most of the original 6 are gone, at least according to reports in the media. I don't know how true that is. Most of the people that I know that voted stayed on board, but there is a huge sector that didn't. And about three seats are coming in from the center-left to support him. Of course, that's during his prime ministership, that's a little different. But the important thing to take away from that is that another poll was done where the public overwhelmingly cares most about the price of living in the state of Israel and the economic side of things, which is Bennett's strong play. Bennett's strongest position in politics is free market, improving the cost of living, lowering prices, getting rid of competition, and all of his Singapore plan that he ran on as a platform. That's clearly matching up with what the public wants. The public, I think it was 49% of the public, put that as the top priority above security, above Iran, above anything else. Bennett's not touching it. I mean, yeah, things are happening behind the scenes, but in the public arena, the things that Bennett's doing day to day is Iran, and yes, Iran's super important, and there's actually a crisis to deal with on an international level now, which is why it has to be front and center. Iran, Corona, political items. If Bennett would just shift focus to the things he's really, really good at, the public cares. And I think these polls will show him that, and I think we may see that going forward a little bit. I think we may see a shift in public policy really geared towards, at least in the messaging, whether the activity changes or not, who knows. But at least the messaging will focus a lot more on how they're improving our quality of life here.
Well, I think that the two matters to that is my first question to you is the fact that, you know, when they passed Chok HaHesderim now, we've discussed it before, we didn't like a lot of it, we didn't like, but in the end, there were a lot of good economic moves that were passed in the law. I feel like that was not publicly, most people I know, the average citizen, has no idea, first of all, in general, has no idea what was passed in that Chok, but definitely doesn't know the good things that were passed. All we know about is the tax on these plasticware and tax things that, again, we bash those taxes enough on the podcast, but we're still not talking about actually a large sum of money. The real large sum of money are some great things that happened that I feel that Bennett, Yamina, the government, barely made a push for the public to know this.
So they did post about it, their social media, they did talk about it, but yeah, that's what I'm talking about. It's the messaging. And I think you're going to see a shift to talk about it more. They compromised on the tax on the soda, and the soda which hasn't actually happened yet, the soda and the plastic. They compromised on that to left-wing parties to get their larger wins on the free market overall, to get rid of import restrictions and everything. While, as a trade, it's a no-brainer. I mean, they got 90% right-wing policies for a pretty minor pieces. But on a PR level, it probably wasn't the right move because the capitulations they made to the left, meaning the tax on the plastic and the tax on the sodas, are extremely public right now. They affect people's pockets today. Today, everything is just a little more expensive because of the moves this government made. The things that they did that are good aren't going to have an effect on our bottom line for a little while. They don't even go into effect through 2020, 2021, 2022, January, some things happen, and then you have a trickle down of the actual numbers until you actually feel the cheaper products. Some things you'll see, for instance, starting January, we're going to have the, woe and behold, miracles are going to occur. I'll be able to buy blueberries and pineapples in the supermarket like a human being. That's going to happen in January. But on a PR level, they need to figure out how to push the messaging that they are positively affecting the price of living for the average Israeli, because right now they're only feeling it in the negative.
Okay, but part of that is also the media. You could also give other things, but like the media wants to focus on the things that are negative, and that's what gets
yes,
more interesting.
Yes, no, don't forget that the media's interest is in the success of this government. Unlike the last 15 years, the media's on board.
The media's interest is in the not failing of this government. That's very different than the success of this government.
No. Showing an alternative to Netanyahu being successful is very important to the media. And I think you can push the messaging. Again, they're going to push back because you got to remember that the media overwhelmingly leans left, also on economics. So if you're going to argue that right-wing economics is going to make life better, which obviously it will if you're not just, I don't know, psychotic, then it's going to be hard to defend, but you got to show numbers. You got to show why the work you're doing is going to affect the bottom line of the consumer. Maybe you have to take some actions that will affect the bottom line today, even if on the macro they're not that important.
I mean, I agree with you that would be a good method for them to take. I also think that it would show sides that we haven't seen yet with showing that Naftali Bennett, you know, is bringing with his government. It's something that Bibi hasn't touched. Everyone agrees that Bibi, even though supporters of Bibi, that Bibi has failed terribly in the economic sector in the last 10 years, as his focus was on.
Even though it's his strong suit, right?
But factually, he didn't focus on it.
Right.
Factually, he didn't take care of when all the prices rose and everything became more difficult from an economic perspective. And I think that Naftali Bennett focusing again, taking out Iran, which you both agreed was just critical, you have to deal with it. His focus actually on the international realm, which is very important to show that he can replace Netanyahu, but the only thing I think, the place that he can beat Netanyahu the best is in the pocket. And if you can show that I'm actually on the ground making things better for the citizens, that can make a big shift, right. But I don't see him focusing on it yet.
But he is focusing in on the activity level. He's doing it, and he's doing it better than anyone ever has. I think the changes the government has made to overall policy on a macro level in the last few months have been greater than anything that's happened in this country in 20 years. It's unbelievable, and it's enough. It alone is enough for them to get my vote personally. But most people are not that savvy. Most people don't understand economics. Most people don't understand any of this. They need to find a way to get quick wins on the bottom line. I don't know what that is, whether it's lowering taxes in specific sectors, and then you have budgetary balance issues. But whatever it is, you need to find a way that the people feel like things are a little better because of you.
Okay, can you give me an example of some significant change you think the government has been pushing forward?
I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, we could talk about the import restrictions that were lifted. As I just said, we'll be able to buy actual exotic fruit soon and not be limited to ridiculous things that are grown inside the state of Israel in a ridiculous attempt to support farmers who just are not sustainable here. But putting all that aside, we could talk about things that are like a little more, I mean, basic, I guess, structural. Kahana's reform of the whole way kashrut works in the state of Israel.
Matan Kahana, the Minister of Religion.
Yeah, the Minister of Religion. He came in, he's a religious guy. He wears a kippah suga. His push has been to restructure how kashrut is handled. For those of you who don't know, as a basic background for how kashrut works in the state of Israel, kashrut is mandated by law in terms of the use of the word. You can only refer to yourself as kosher if you were given kashrut by the Rabbanut HaRashit. Only the Rabbanut HaRashit is allowed to determine if something is kosher or not. On top of that, you were then allowed to augment your kashrut by pairing other private organizations like badatzes or other kinds of mahadrins that are out there. But you have to pay the Rabbanut plus that other organization to double up. But the Rabbanut's the only one allowed to give kashrut. It's a monopoly on the kashrut. This has led to huge, huge problems over the years. People don't trust them. There's a lot of corruption. The way it's structured is that the mashgiach is paid directly by the restaurant, which means the leverage on the mashgiach is by the restaurant owner. And if the restaurant is losing out or can threaten him to not pay him, he's going to be more lenient. There's a lot of problems with how it's currently structured. So there's been discussion a long time about how we shift this, how we move this. In general, public sentiment is extremely negative towards the Rabbanut HaRashit for a lot of reasons. They are not a good organization. Even though it's sad because, you know, the state of Israel and its chief rabbinate and that whole concept of building up this institution failed miserably and it became a bunch of bureaucrats that are really self-interested and just try to get themselves paid. To that end, a reform was passed and is in process of happening. That's two stages. The base stage is going into effect now is essentially trying to say that the Rabbanut HaRashit is going to become a regulator, not a giver of kashrut. The rights being stripped from them. They're no longer allowed to go and give kashrut. That's a later stage of the program. But private organizations are going to be allowed to open up a kashrut. They have to be licensed by the Rabbanut HaRashit. That's where we're still giving them the authority that they meet specific standards the Rabbanut set for what is kosher and what is not. And then these organizations will compete in the marketplace. That'll lower the price of kashrut for everyone across the board. For anywhere that needs badatz plus or anything else, they won't have to double up. They can just pay the badatz and not pay the rabbanut plus badatz because the badatz is now licensed to give kashrut by the rabbanut. It's pretty well structured, and I think the biggest defense for this is that this is how we've all operated in supermarkets forever. Any product imported into the state of Israel has kashrut by the OU, the CRC, any of the ORB, any of the large organizations. But Ishur HaRabbanut HaRashit, the Rabbanut HaRashit determined that organization is good enough, and then it gets kashrut through the Rabbanut HaRashit into Israel. So basically, the restaurants would work the same way. Pretty simple. Of course, the Rabbanut HaRashit is now losing power in their eyes, and it's an attack on religion, and how dare you. Both Rabbanim Rashiim, struggle to use those words, but both of the individuals that occupy those seats have come out with horrible curses against this, against him. The whole right ring, religiously, I guess, of the map has just been attacking this as if it's Dom Vamara and the end of all religion in the state of Israel, when it's really just a really basic improvement of a given system that will help everyone eat better kosher food.
So this is my question that I don't understand in the sphere. You said before that, you know, places have a rabbanut and then they have the badatz. Now you're going to have, you know, let's say this passes through, we're going to move 5 years from now, 10 years from now, you're going to have 15 organizations that give kashrus in the country, okay, private organizations. But I, as a consumer in my area of Gush Etzion, is going to come and say, I only accept a rabbanut from a Harav Schreiber. Only that kashrus do I eat. And you're going to say, I only eat badatz. And you're going to say this. So I'm, as a consumer, I'm still going to have to, because when I still pay one company for their kashrus. I don't need to pay the rabbanut anymore. But I'm still going to have to pay the same multiple organizations, because each community is going to eat their own private organization's kashrus and not trust the kashrus of someone else. Why is it any different than the current situation?
No, not at all. Because the market will play itself out, right? Is it worth it for the restaurant to get 7 kashriyot because you want it? Probably not. It's a market question. And at the end of the day, most people that live in one place tend to hold more or less the same thing. So the place in Efrat is going to make sure that they get a kashrut that most people in Efrat are good with.
So it's most. It still means that when I go to place, I'm constantly up. And now when I go, even when I go to someone, I don't like badatz. But if I go there, they have the rabbanut. Okay, I'm a clean mind because there's rabbanut everywhere in the country. So anywhere that I go, the rabbanut is
Ali. That's still true, though. That's still true because all these organizations are licensed by the rabbanut. They are all at the same level of the rabbanut, but better because the rabbanut's a disaster. So every one of them meets that basic standard that you're already okay with. As long as it has a kosher certificate on it, that means it's licensed by the Brut Roshit the same way that the OU and the CRC and the ORB and all those are. It's the same thing. It might as well be the OU. It may be the OU. The OU very easily may decide they'll just launch operations in Israel now and organize the kosher industry here. You'll probably end up having 3 or 4 major players that end up being on the field, and you'll have the local municipalities, right? The Matzah Datit of a given place gives a hesher. That's what happens in Efrat. In Efrat, Kashrut comes from the Mu'atzad Datit through the Brut Roshit.
Now, do I pay? Does each one charge whatever sum they want to charge?
Yeah, that's the point.
I, as a private organization, can decide any sum of money that I want to charge.
Yeah.
That's great. That is an issue, because then it still tells you that this badatz, you know, that if the Dachredit says, we're only eating this rabbi, he can just charge whatever amount of money he wants.
Right, and then the Haredim won't be able to afford to eat there. That's fine. That's good. That forces the market to equalize. Anytime pricing is free, it's better. Always, unless the market is locked. But if we're not locking the market,
and how do we stop the rabbanut from not giving anyone the allowance to give this kashrus? They'll say, no, we don't approve them. They're not good enough. We don't approve them. They're not good enough.
So that's the current problem. The current problem that we're having, that this reform is having, is that the rabbanut is basically boycotting it and saying, well, we're just not playing ball. And it does rely on them to be a regulator. Now they're biting themselves in the foot, because right now this is basically an approach that's trying to leave them with the majority of the authority. If they choose not to, someone else is going to do it, and it won't be them. They're currently kicking and screaming and fighting, but they're going to cave because they have no leverage here whatsoever. Like, at all. Another really important move, changing topics for a second, that happened just yesterday. In the committee for dealing with the needs of handicapped people and their compensation and how all of that works, a very, very important decision was pushed forward by Bennett and his government that basically, so the way it's worked until now, and I believe it works similarly in most places in the United States as well. I know Medicare works this way. If you're eligible for a stipend for your handicap or whatever else, for Social Security of any kind, and then you go out and work, the money you'd get from Social Security or from Medicare or from your Kitzbat Nechut, as it's called here, would be taken off based on your salary. So, right, if you were getting 3,000 shekel a month as a kitzbah,
you'd reduce that
and then you go work and you make 7,000 shekel, 3,000 shekel would be reduced, or you just wouldn't get your kitzbah, however they structure it, to match it up. So basically what you're doing is disincentivizing people to go out and work. And that's bad for everyone. It's bad for the market, it's bad for the economy, and it's bad for the individuals, because working is very, very important for longevity, and health, and especially for people with disabilities to integrate with society. And they've just been disincentivized from working because of stupid, archaic rules. So yesterday, this rule was changed from what I understood of it, not all the details were publicized. They just published the overall rule, so we'd have to see how it's actually implemented in practice. But they're picking an exemption so that your kitzvah is not connected to your salary. You're allowed to make money, and your kitzvah is something you get that's supposed to augment because you had this difficulty.
Okay, so this is my two questions. One, who is the person that's against this concept? Why would this be done differently in the United States? And my second part of that, it seems to me like it would be flipped around. It seems to me like the left economic wing, which wants to up, you know, benefits and up thing, would be like, yeah, of course, give more money out from the money we have. And the right wing economists would say, no, slow down. We want to have to give that. We would like to reduce the money from it. Do you not feel this is backwards?
No, I don't think it's a right and left fight. Meaning, I don't think Bennett was fighting with the left wing of his camp to get this done. It's my understanding of the issue, and it's not an issue that I understand really deeply or have looked that much into, is that it usually tends to be just a bureaucratic question. It's okay, these people have a hard time working, so we give them X. But if they can work, then we shouldn't give them. Like, on a very, very basic grand scheme level, it seems to make sense as a policy.
That there's a minimum, right. They need to live with X amount of money a month.
But you do have a job, so I don't need to give you the money. But the back end of that is what actually happens, is that you disincentivize people from going to work. Very similar to what we saw post-COVID with all the that never ended, and people were just like, it's not worth it for me to work because, I'll make 2,000 shekel more, but I'll be working 45 hours a week. It's just not worth it. So at the end of the day, it was a net negative. It's much better as a society to decide, and this is a right-wing, left-wing question, of how much do we support the weaker members of our society? Is it the government's responsibility to be that support, or is it more of a local responsibility or family? You could debate those issues, and that's pure right-wing, left-wing economic policies. But it shouldn't be connected from someone's ability to work, because that is negative for everyone involved.
Okay, so for our final topic of this week,
We want to jump into what happened in the committee to elect new Supreme Court members. I don't know how much you guys have been talking about this, but the committee's been meeting for a little while now. There are 4 seats up for grabs in the Supreme Court. And there's a committee that appoints them. Unlike in America, where you have a process and it goes through public trials, none of that happens here. There's a committee that's very specifically weighed out, and they basically all compromise. Typically, it's split evenly between the Lawyers Guild, their union. The judges get to basically appoint their own judge, and the absurdity of our whole system. And I'm sure you guys have talked about the absurdity of our judicial system many times. Now there is a balance with this government that's trying to push pretty hard for more conservative judges. They kind of want to appoint 2 and 2. The importance of this is that if they manage to appoint 2 conservative judges, you're balancing the court 50-50. The court will then be 50% conservative, and that has a lot of ramifications. As we know, the courts in Israel are a big problem. They've been stuck. They haven't been able to compromise on one specific individual out of the 4 for a very long time now. And yesterday, I think, or maybe 2 days ago, they announced that they were going to basically pause the election the process because they can't reach a compromise, and they're going to try to widen the names. They're currently like 6 on the list. They want to widen it to a wider list so they could find someone who meets the criteria that both people are fighting for and find some kind of compromise. So they're going to push it off for a few months. Very interesting. We can take it over from here.
So I think that there's a couple things here. First of all, just to come out and say how huge this is. You know, it's so interesting as citizens. I would give, I'm throwing out, let me be clear, my own estimated number here. But I would say that 98% of the country have no idea this is even happening, have no idea the relevance of this. And it just seems like another news article. And I think it is so huge. The election and the nomination of Supreme Court judges in this country as our listeners know, and if you don't know, then we'll specify the Supreme Court has an extensive amount of power in this country and basically run half the things that happen here. This is a big issue that we discussed for separate reasons, but that's not something that's changing anytime soon. And this has, like, almost more important, way more important than elections, which happens and could, you know, come and go. And even with this election right now, where Naftali Bennett took over and maybe this was huge, you're still talking about something that in the most extensive scenario, in 4 years, there's elections again, okay? And we all know it's not going to be 4 years from now, but that's the longest possible scenario. The judges that are going to be nominated and appointed now can be in their position for 20 years forward, looking ahead. And that's why this is such a huge situation that's going through and so important. The second part of it is that you're really saying that when they can't come to this compromise and they're going, and I want you to touch in a second what it means that they decided to push it off and what it means that they gave a temporary person in a position and what the ramifications of that is. But I think it's interesting where it really points that they're probably looking for a certain lawyer that could fill in that position. Someone that's actually different than normal. It's, I assume it's going to be someone that's kind of a no-name. It's kind of a more quieter guy that people less know of that has the position, which didn't piss off either side yet. And then that will be a nominee that's more probable.
Well, maybe. The thing is, the thing they're looking for isn't an individual. They're looking for someone who meets specific criteria. They're looking for someone who comes from the private sector. That was one of the criteria that's being required of this last appointee, that they worked in the private and they're not part of the public sector previously. And then also that it's a conservative seat. And will meet the requirements of Esther Chayut, the head of the Supreme, the Chief Justice. The temporary appointment that they did was actually very, very interesting. They appointed a judge to a temporary 6-month post so that they could fill the seat so that the court could continue to operate. This hasn't happened in 15 years, I think. It's been a very long time since this was used.
And it only happened once.
Yeah, and it was basically nixed as a horrible idea because Barack used to use this as a way to basically make sure the judges do what he wants. It was power over the court. Basically, they would appoint the judge on a temporary appointment and watch and see, well, if he rules the way I want him to, I'll give him a permanent appointment, and if he doesn't, then he's out. It was a way for the Knesset to gain sway over the courts, and immediately everyone recognized this as a really, really bad idea and stopped doing it.
This was a power play against the courts or for the courts?
Against the courts.
The Knesset gained out of this.
Yeah. This was a way for the government to control the rulings of the court because basically it was a threat looming over all the judges' heads that they'd only get appointed permanently if they... Because there's no, like, limit to that term. They were, like, kind of indefinite, non-permanent position. So it's do what I say or you're out. Really, really bad. It was argued against. Sa'ar appointed this guy basically using this loophole in the law, whatever you want to call it. And he got attacked for it pretty strongly, but I thought his justification was also very, very good. He basically said, yeah, there's a lot of problems with this situation, but what I did was appoint someone who isn't allowed to sit permanently. Basically, he only has 3 years left till retirement, which means he cannot be appointed to the court in a permanent position. So that whole problem that you were having of the threat of becoming permanent or not, no, this guy's not permanent, period. So he can rule however he wants because he has the 6-month period and that's it. So he's avoiding that issue and saying that this is the best solution given our current stalemate. And I think he's right.
And this is very interesting, but does the Chief Justice not have power here to accept or not accept the temporary position?
Chief Justice had to agree.
So she did agree to
this. She did agree to this person. She agreed to this individual being on the court. Everyone agreed because, yeah, really, it doesn't pose a threat to the court. The person's pretty neutral. And also it had to do with the cases that are coming up in the next 6 months that weren't super important, I think, for either side.
But what do we think is going to happen in 6 months? We're just hoping to find someone that
in
works
that time,
on both sides.
They're expanding the list and reevaluating the list. They will eventually compromise. They always do. I mean, they'll appoint someone.
Until they appoint another temporary in 6 months from now, that's a different person that's going to be a temporary judge.
I mean, maybe, but one side will typically cave. Usually the political side caves, but someone will, and we'll get our appointees.
Okay, and with that, we'd like to conclude this week's episode. We thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed. We'll see you next week. Yitzi, thank you very much for joining us for this week's podcast. This is Here We Go Again.